Now put your placemats up so I can see it, will you? I think they'll fold and I'll talk to you when we get to that church. We'll do that. Okay, you've heard the message, right? You got the whole two chapters all together? Did you absorb everything that you just heard? No. Isn't it amazing, with all the voices in the room, trying to focus on just one church was a good idea because you couldn't hear what the other churches were getting read, could you? And amazing, with all the voices in the world that are telling us what this means in the book of Revelation, how do you figure out exactly what we should take out of the book? You could read any six books from the Christian bookstore or from the church library on the book of Revelation, and I would be pretty certain that you'd hear six different opinions on what the book of Revelation is. All of the voices that are being made to hear. So I'm not going to tell you that I know the last word about Revelation. I have read a lot of those books, but I do want to point out two things about each church. And here's what the two churches are. The first thing, I want you to know that Jesus knows where we live. And I have never seen it so clearly outlined as in the first, the second and third chapters of the book of Revelation. This is a truth that I think I grew up with. Jesus knows who I am. Jesus loves me. And I believe that I was taught from the time I was a child that Jesus would hear my prayer, and if I were the only person on earth, Jesus would have come to die for me. But I have never seen it so clearly as I've seen it in the story of the seven churches in the book of Revelation. So I want to point that out tonight, and when you leave tonight, you will be a long way down the road at understanding that Jesus knows where you live, because he knows where these people lived in the seven churches, and he knows where you live too. Now last night we did one church, the Church of Pergamum. We'll just brush by it today. Tomorrow we're going to finish with the book of Laodicea, so that leaves five. And I think what I'm going to do is just go until it's time to stop, and if I've got two churches left for tomorrow or three, then I'll just take care of it tomorrow. I apologize for going so long last night. I get going on this topic and it's kind of hard to stop. So we'll just keep going, but we don't have to finish all seven churches, one of them at least, maybe two, tomorrow, okay? So don't worry about where we are. First thing I want you to know is that Jesus knows where you live and where I live. The second thing is the promise of Jesus to each of the churches. Now, those are the two things on your outline for each church. You look down there. There are two subpoints under each church, and those are the two things. And I think when we're through tonight, we'll find something that's really fascinating about these letters to seven churches. I was telling my friends here when I came here tonight, just what happened to me yesterday happened to me again today. I saw something in the study that I've never seen before, and I'll share it with you in just a minute, but it's so exciting when the Bible does that for you. You just keep going. So we will start with the church at Ephesus. Now I'm going to talk to you because that's the letter that you wrote, but all of you listen in to see if you can see those two things. And there is no better way to explain the two things I want to share with you than to talk about the church at Ephesus. Jesus gave to John the messages to give to the churches. Jesus knew each of the churches, where they were, what was going on, what their good points were, and what their challenges were. And then John turned around to write a letter to each of these churches. Now John knew these churches because he was a pastor and he lived there. But his first pastoral responsibility was in the church of Ephesus. The tradition of the early church fathers is that after the crucifixion, when Jesus from the cross said to John, "This is your mother, mother, this is your son," that John took Mary away from the persecution that was centered in Jerusalem and took her all the way north into Asia Minor, into what is today Turkey, to the city of Ephesus, and that he was pastor there as long as Mary was alive. And sometime a little bit later on, the persecution started, and it was from Ephesus that John was taken to the Isle of Patmos. And after the emperor died and John got off of Patmos, he went back to Ephesus. But all throughout the area, in a pretty close proximity, are these seven churches, and John kept going from place to place. Have any of you been to Ephesus? A few of you have. It's one of the most beautiful archaeological ruins in the world. The city comes down one street and turns right at the great library that has been reconstructed by a group of Belgium archaeologists. And then you walk all the way down to the amphitheater where Paul preached and where John was. It's an amazing city. And in John's time, it was the greatest city in Asia. Yesterday I told you about Pergamum being the capital city, the most important city, because it was where the governor of the province was. But Ephesus was the greatest city because it had this beautiful harbor that came right up to where Ephesus was. And Ephesus was on the road from east to west where all the travel in the Roman Empire went. And the ships would come in, and it's just gorgeous. Now today, if you stand in the amphitheater, you can still see the harbor, but it's 6 miles away because the river has brought silt down and deposited it in the shoreline, and the shore has receded far the way out. Of all the things in Ephesus that made it a great city, it was a cultural center, it had a wonderful library, it was a religious center, it was a magnificent city. There was a place where they just went to hear music in Ephesus. But the greatest thing about Ephesus turned out to be one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. It was the beautiful temple of Diana. In the Greek, Diana is called Artemis, and we read about her in the book of Acts and the temple that's there. But let me tell you about this temple to Diana. It was one of the largest temples ever built. Many of you have been to the Acropolis in Greece, to the Parthenon. The temple of Diana was four times as big as the Acropolis, as the Parthenon on the Acropolis in Athens. It was surrounded by these massive pillars, and the pillars, 60 of them, were gilded in gold as gifts from different kings in the area as they gave it to the people of Ephesus. And there in the middle of the temple of Ephesus was a statue of Diana. And the whole temple was one of the seven wonders of the world, with the pyramids and all the other wonders. This was one of them. If you go there today, you're lucky if you see one pillar still standing. And it's very clear when you see that pillar that it was put together from different pillars from different places. One pillar with a capital on top, and on top of the capital, a nest of storks that's a permanent fixture there. And that's all there is. But in John's time, it was one of the wonders of the ancient world. And the priests to the temple that worked in the temple of Diana were stronger here in Ephesus than they were in any other place. And so John wrote the words of Jesus to the little Christian church in the city that had one of the wonders of the ancient world. And John wanted to know that Jesus' message was crafted just for them. And so look what he says to the church of Ephesus, Chapter 2, verse 1. These are the words of him who holds the seven stars in his right hand and walks among the seven golden... I know your deeds, your hard work, your perseverance. I know that you cannot tolerate wicked men, that you have tested those who claim to be apostles but are not. You have persevered. Yet, verse 4, I have something against you. You have forsaken your first love. And notice verse 5, remember the height from which you have fallen. When the man stood up in church on the Sabbath morning in Ephesus and said, I have a letter from John that claims to be the words of Jesus for our church, when he got to that verse, remember the heights from which you are fallen, the people in the church at Ephesus knew that that letter was written for them and not for anybody else in the world. Remember the heights from which you were fallen. In the most holy place of the temple of Diana was a statue of Diana. It's not the great statue of Zeus that was one of the wonders of the world. This was an ugly little stone, dark in color, with bumps all over it, that had been fashioned into the image that the priest of Diana thought was what Diana was supposed to be. And they had gotten the stone one day after a meteorite shower. They had gone out into the field close by to Ephesus, and there was a meteorite that had fallen from heaven. And they picked it up, fashioned it into the temple of Diana, into the image of Diana, and put it in the most holy place. Let me show you this verse in Acts chapter 19. You want to turn back, hold your fingers in Revelation, and look at Acts chapter 19. This whole chapter is about the riot in Ephesus when Paul was there. You remember the story? Demetrius is a silversmith who makes images to Diana. He's copying this image. And Demetrius whips everybody up into a fury to say these people are taking away our livelihood. And look at verse 35. The city clerk quieted the crowd and said, Men of Ephesus, doesn't all the world know that the city of Ephesus is the guardian of the temple of the great Artemis, Diana, and of her image which fell from heaven? Now, when John says, remember the great heights from which you had fallen, the hairs on the back of the necks of the people in Ephesus must have stood up. He's talking to us. This is written for us. If those words had been given to the church at Laodicea or Pergamum or Thyatira or Sardis, it would have meant nothing to them. It had to be chosen just for the people of Ephesus. And in that choosing, Jesus is saying to the people at Ephesus, I know where you live. It's exactly what's going on. If it were the only instance like this in the seven churches, we might think this is a coincidence, but it's not. It goes on and on and on, and I can't wait to share that with you tonight. But before we get there, let me show you. Oh, I haven't changed this. This one is the height from which you've fallen. And then let me show you what the promise of Jesus is. Do you see it in the very end of the message to the church, that they are promised that they will eat from the tree of life? Here's what I discovered today in studying this that I'd never seen before. Every one of the promises that Jesus makes to the churches is fulfilled in the last couple of chapters in the book of Revelation. Look at this. Revelation 22:14. Blessed are those who wash their robes that they may have the right to the tree of life. How do you and I get the right to eat from the tree of life? Is it because the right is given to us on the basis of something that you and I have done? No. It is because we've washed our robes, and we talked about this last night. Where do we wash our robes? In the blood of the Lamb. And it's the blood of the Lamb that makes the tree of life available to you and me. So here we have in chapter 2 the promise that they'll eat from the tree of life, and at the very end of Revelation, there it is again, the tree of life whose leaves are spread out for the healing of the nations. And here is the promise: if you wash your robes in the blood of the Lamb, you have the right to it. It's not because of what you've done, it's because of the blood of the Lamb. There are a few passages in the book of Revelation, in the chapters 2 and 3, that talk about giving to us according to what we are due. Don't be troubled by them tonight. I'm going to talk about them tomorrow. They're actually a wonderful part of the doctrine of salvation by grace. Come tomorrow, we'll talk some more about that. Let me move on to the church at Smyrna. Smyrna is, while Ephesus is the greatest city in Asia, and Pergamum is the capital city of Asia, Smyrna is the most beautiful city in Asia. It sits on a beautiful hill, and it's a great place. This word is given to Smyrna, the people who, from the man who had died and come to life again. Let me tell you a couple things about Smyrna that I just absolutely love. 1,000 years B.C., so 1,100 years before John is writing to the church at Smyrna, Smyrna was established by the Greeks as a beautiful city. It sits at the base of a little hill, and on that hill is a street that goes around the top. It's called the Pagos Hill. There's a street that goes around about two-thirds of the way up, and they began to build temples to the gods on that little hill, on the hill of Pagos, two-thirds of the way up. So if you stopped before you entered into the city of Smyrna and looked up to the hill that was the background to this place, you would see the hill and this little ring of temples that were right above the city. And the people called the hill the crown of Smyrna. And it was such a beautiful place, they called Smyrna the crown of Asia. It was this gorgeous city. The breezes wafted in and kept it nice and cool. It was just a great place. But 1,000 years before John wrote, it had been established, and it had been there for about 400 years. And then the people from Smyrna fell in a battle in 600 B.C., and the city ceased to exist. There were villages here and there out into where the Bedouins would live in the desert, but nobody lived in Smyrna for 400 years. If we go back 400 years in American history to the beginning of the 17th century, what's going on in America in the early 1600s? 1607, do you know this date? Founding of Jamestown, the first English colony in America, 1607. Europeans had been here only for 100 years, a little more than 100 years. Go back 400 years in our history, and the world is totally different. Well, for 400 years, Smyrna ceased to exist. That's a long time for a city. And then about 200 years B.C., they decided they would build the city up again. And a Roman came in and measured the land that the city anciently sat on and decided that what he would do was to build this beautiful city with all of the streets going exactly north and south and east and west, and they would plant these beautiful trees and they would take advantage of the winds that blew through there. And he planned a utopia, a perfect city in Smyrna. When John writes to the church, the little Christian church in Smyrna, and says, this is from the man who had died and came to life again, the Christians in the church knew that that letter was written for them and nobody else, because they now lived in a city who had been dead and came to life 400 years later. But more than that, the promise to the church was that they would be given a crown of life. Do you remember what Smyrna was called by all the people in Rome? The crown of Asia. And there was the little Pagos hill with the crown of Smyrna around it. And Jesus promises to them the crown of life. When the people at Smyrna heard that, they knew that Jesus knew where they lived and that he knew what challenges they faced. He knew what opportunities they had, where they were growing, and where they needed to do a better job. And the message is, for you and me, that Jesus knows exactly where you and I live and the challenges that we face and the opportunities we have. A little bit later in the book of Revelation, almost to the end, we find this beautiful verse. It's a whole passage in chapter 19, verses 11 to 17. When Jesus, now with the name on his forehead, King of Kings and Lord of Lords, comes back to the earth, leading the armies of heaven, and John sees him and he says, I saw a white horse whose rider is called Faithful and True, and on his head are many crowns. Why does Jesus need more than one crown? The crown says, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. That's the only one you need, isn't it? You put that one on somebody's head, they're the supreme ruler. I think there are those many crowns in his head because he wants to give one to you and to you and to me. The many crowns are the crowns that are going to be given to us when Jesus comes back. And then there's going to be that wonderful moment where he calls all of us together. He's already placed the crowns on our head, and we'll get in a large square formation around him. He's standing right in the middle, and all of us standing there with the crowns that Jesus has placed on our heads, and he holds up his hands, and we realize this is a moment to worship, and we kneel down, and the first thing that Jesus says is, how did you get here? What are you doing here? And we're told that what we will do is to take the crown off of our head and cast it at the feet of Jesus. And we say, we're here because I've washed my robe in the blood of the Lamb. We're here because Jesus died to save me. No other reason. In the Great Controversy, page 665, always wished it was on the next page, but it wasn't. Page 665, it says that no one will be there at that moment who remembers or insists on anything that they have sacrificed or done. But the theme of every song, and this verse is taken from the end of the book of Revelation, salvation belongs to God and to the Lamb. We're not going to be talking about what we did. We're going to be talking about what Jesus did when we cast our crowns at his feet. The crowns that you and I wear are from him, not from something we've done. Isn't that a great story about Smyrna? But wait, there's more. Last night we looked at Pergamum and we saw how the sharp double-edged sword was held by Jesus. And I told you last night that because it was a capital city, the governors of Pergamum in that area had the right of the sword. They could execute anybody that they found guilty in their courts. And John was telling the church there, don't worry about it. Jesus has the final say. Jesus has the sharp double-edged sword. And then this wonderful promise that we talked about last night about the hidden manna. When the Ark of the Covenant is revealed again, the Messiah will have come. And you and I will eat from the manna that is everlasting. But look what John said about this, putting these words in Jesus' mouth. In John 5, verse 58, Jesus said, your forefathers ate manna and died. But he who feeds on this bread will live forever. What's he talking about, this bread? He's talking about himself. So the manna is what Jesus brings back when he brings back himself. And the fact that we will eat the hidden manna means that we partake of the very nature of Jesus. Let me move on to the church of Thyatira. This church is the one that we know the least of. We know less of it. That's for you right there. We know less of Thyatira than any of the other churches. But we know something really important about it. And the message to the church at Thyatira is very interesting. Look in chapter 2, verses 18 to 19. It's the church we know less about, but it's the church that has the most words. Jesus says in verse 19, "I know your deeds, your love and your faith, your service and your perseverance, and that you are now doing more than you did at first." What we know about Thyatira is that the Romans put a garrison at Thyatira to protect the city of Pergamum that was not too far away. Pergamum, you remember, is the capital city of the region. But the roads that come into Pergamum come from all directions. And on one of those roads, the one that's most traveled, the Romans put a new garrison there and built up a city to support the garrison. But the job of the garrison was to protect the people at Pergamum, not to protect themselves. So whenever an invading army came into the territory, they first had this go through the city of Thyatira. And the job of the Roman soldiers in Thyatira was to protect the church at the city of Pergamum, the capital city, not to protect themselves. And so they did this terrible thing. They would rush out en masse to meet the invading army, and they would just throw themselves into the battle. And the invading army would kill all of the soldiers there, but it took a long time. And by the time that battle was over, the word had gotten to Pergamum to get your defenses ready because the army was coming. And so the job of these people was to protect the next city, not to do it there. And they persevered in that, even though all of the soldiers in Thyatira would be killed. They would send more soldiers in the next time, and the people in Thyatira would build up the garrison there and support the soldiers were there, and another army would come, and those guys would go out to fight, and they'd be slaughtered again. But word would get to Pergamum that the army was coming. And time after time, in fact, it got to the place where the invading armies finally caught on to what was going on, and they began to send a larger force to go around Thyatira on both sides. And so the Roman garrison at Thyatira was built up. Now they had to do more than they had done before, not just head on with one column of an invading army, but now they had to meet them all over the place. So you see, when the people in the little Christian church at Thyatira, when the man got up to read the letter and he says, "I know your deeds, your love and faith, your servants and your perseverance, and that you are now doing more than you did at first," the people at Thyatira knew that Jesus knew where they lived, that Jesus had the entire history of that little garrison in mind, and he crafted the words exactly so the church at Thyatira would be encouraged and supported by the fact that Jesus knew where they lived. And then the promise is a beautiful promise. The morning star. "If you overcome, I will give you the morning star." Now that has caused some problems for a few people, because we know the Old Testament tells the story of a creature that was born in heaven, created in heaven, who was a light bearer, who was a brilliant light, who was originally a perfect human being, who became Lucifer, Satan. Lucifer became Satan. And some people have been struck by this. I will give you the morning star. And they have tried to make that the victory over Satan is what Jesus is promising here. But notice at the end of the book of Revelation, this verse, chapter 22, verse 16, Jesus is talking and he says, I am the root and offspring of David, the bright and morning star. Once again, just like all of the promises to all of the churches, this is a promise of Jesus himself. Jesus is going to be ours when we get to heaven. The promise is spectacular, isn't it? Isn't it stunning that every one of these is about Jesus? I have to admit that my favorite of these stories is from the Church of Sardis. Who's the Church of Sardis? Is that you back there? No? Where are you? Where are you? Over there. Okay. This is for the Church of Sardis, and I just love this story because it is as clear as anything. Now, the first church, Ephesus, with the temple and Diana, I think that's just stunningly clear. And the last church, Laodicea, which we'll look at tomorrow, it's not just clear once, but over and over and over again. It's so clear that Jesus knows where they live. But this is a story that's just magnificent. Jesus says to these people, wake up. Here's the story about this. Sardis is unlike the other cities in Asia, which are generally built on the plain in front of a hill. Sardis is built on the top of a 1,500-foot cliff that rises up out of the valley. There's a little meandering river below that flowed with gold. And the people at Sardis had encampments down below by the river where they mined, panned for gold. And they became very, very rich. They built their city up on the top of Mount Timolus, 1,500 feet straight up on a sheer cliff out of the desert. And because of the place where they built the city, it was impregnable to any attack. You couldn't come to the base of the cliff and climb straight up the cliff to go to Sardis because it just you couldn't get there. So the only way to get to Sardis was to walk way around the mountain range that was there and then come at Sardis from the back. There was only one pathway. So the people at Sardis built a huge wall there. And when they defended their city, they put their army there. And they had never been beaten. And had been up for a long, long time when John was there. In 600 BC, the country of Lydia was the ruler in this area. And there was a king of Lydia who lived in Sardis by the name of Croesus, C-R-O-E-S-U-S. And Croesus is practically a fable in the literature of the time because of where he lived and the gold that was in this river. He became the richest man in the ancient world. And the statement was, you are as rich as Croesus. If you could be that rich, you didn't need anything else as rich as Croesus. Croesus sat up in his city looking out over all of the plain that was there. And he knew that his army was unbeatable. There was nothing that could defeat his army. And so he decided he would go and attack other people. He would attack them, conquer them with his army, and then he would retreat to Sardis up on his high plateau. He was safe from anybody's retaliation. And then he got a little bit too big for his britches, and he decided that he would attack none other than Cyrus, the king of Persia. And to get there, he took his army down through Asia Minor on ships across to Greece, and then went up through Greece to attack Persia. And on the way, he stopped in the Greek city of Delphi. And in Delphi was one of the most famous people in the ancient world, a prophetess called the Oracle of Delphi. Have you heard of her? She lived in a cave there in Delphi, and it was dark in there. You could never really see who she was, but there were great stories of her being a scraggly old woman with long gray hair, and she would throw the bones in front of the fire and predict what was going to happen. And many people went to the Oracle of Delphi to get an idea of what they should do in the future, including Croesus. He stops at Delphi, and he went to the oracle, and he sat there. He brought sacrifices, the payment that he needed to go, and he told her what he was about to do. I'm going to go to Persia and attack Cyrus, and I want to know if I'll be successful. And the oracle went into cantations, and she threw her bones, her little chicken bones, and she put it out by the fire. And she said to Croesus, if you cross the river Halys, which is the next river to the north, a great nation will be destroyed. And Croesus said, that's it. That's all I needed. I'm on my way to destroy the great nation of Persia. So he left with his army. They went north. They attacked Cyrus and were defeated terribly. The oracle said, all I said to him was, if you cross the river, a great nation will be destroyed, but I didn't say which nation. It's kind of like a weather person. You can be right, 50% chance of rain, you know. It was that kind of a thing. Well, Croesus was not destroyed by the defeat. He returned to Sardis, and he got all of his army up there with the Persian army in pursuit to find them and finish the job that they had started. And they camped all down below Mount Timaeus, all in front of the city of Sardis, way up there, 1,500 feet up, and they sieged the city for a long time, but nothing happened. Because the people had plenty of water, they had plenty of food, nobody came out, and the Persian army was beginning to wonder, how are we ever going to get up there and defeat those people? One night, in a campfire where the Persian army was camped, there were a group of soldiers that were on watch to see what was going on. And they looked up, 1,500 feet up there, you could see the wall of Sardis, and they heard the laughter of several soldiers from the city who were talking about how they had gotten away from the Persian army and nothing ever could defeat them in Sardis. And one of the soldiers who was laughing up there took his helmet off and he put it on the wall. And as they were talking and probably drinking too much, one of these moments, one of the soldiers gestured like this, and he knocked the helmet off of the wall, and it came tumbling down the 1,500 feet and landed just at the base of the cliff over there. So the Persian soldiers watched what was going to happen next. And about 20 minutes later, a soldier from Sardis appeared and picked up the helmet. Now, how did that happen, they wondered. Could he have gone all the way to the back and come all the way around the mountain to pick up the helmet? No, it wasn't possible. So one Persian soldier followed the guy who picked up the helmet. And it turned out that in this great cliff, 1,500 feet up, were a lot of fissures, and the people from Sardis had created a pathway that was a secret pathway, and they could get up the mountain real quickly by just walking up that pathway. So the Persian soldier went back, told the commanders, and they put all of the Persian army together and quietly that night walked up the hill through the pathway to get to Sardis. And when they got there, they found out that the gates were not even locked. And everybody had gone home and gone to bed. They were so secure that nobody was watching. Everybody was home asleep. And so the Persian army went in the open gates and defeated Sardis once and for all. Now imagine what happens if you are in the little Christian church in Sardis and you read the letter from John and you read this: "Wake up! Strengthen what remains and is about to die, for I have not found your deeds complete in the sight of God. And again, wake up, or I will come like a thief, and you will not know at what time I will come to you." There was no question in the Christians at Sardis that that letter was written just for them. And they knew that unless they woke up, their fate would be exactly like the fate of the people who lived long ago in the city of Sardis, the impregnable city of Sardis. They knew it because they knew their history, and it would be repeated in the church if they didn't wake up, or Jesus would come like a thief in the night. The promise is made to the people at Sardis: I will write your name in the book of life. This is a beautiful story about the book of life. Let me just show you a couple verses and then we're going to close. Revelation 21:27. The people that get to heaven are only those whose names are written in the Lamb's book of life. Your name and my name is there tonight. It's been there for a long time. Look at this. Revelation 17:8. Written in the book of life from the creation of the world. Before this world was created, the Godhead looked down into the history of Corona Seventh-day Adventist Church, and he looked at you and me, and he says, "I know where you live, and your name was written in the Lamb's book of life." Before the creation of the world, because Revelation 13:8 says, it's written in the book of life, belonging to the Lamb that was slain from the creation of the world. When was Jesus slain? Well, we tend to say at Calvary. But before the creation of the world, Jesus promised that he would die to demonstrate how much God loves us. And when God promises, it's fulfilled. So the Bible writers can say that Jesus was slain from the creation of the world. Look at this, Ephesians 1:4. God chose us in Jesus before the creation of the world. Our names have been there all that time. And Matthew 25:34, Jesus says this: "Come, you who are blessed by my Father, take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world." It's a wonderful truth that it's before you and I had any chance to do anything wrong, and before you and I had any chance to work our way or merit or obey our way into heaven, our names were written in the Lamb's book of life. It's a promise that we're there. Well, that's where we're going to stop tonight. Philadelphia and Laodicea tomorrow, we can do that. I've already gone past the time I told you I wouldn't go past. I'm just so sorry. But thank you for your attention. You know, a good teacher would get everybody talking and not just talk the whole time. So I apologize for that too. Stan, are you going to pray for us?
Well, I have a couple of things I'd like to say.